So welcome back, everybody, to the Drink and Learn podcast. I am drinks historian Elizabeth Pierce, and today I am very delighted to be joined by author Shaughnessy Bishop-Stahl, who is, well, a writer, a teacher. Dare I call you a bon vivant?
Sure, why not? Let's keep
going. And he's the author of Hungover, The Morning After, and One Man's Quest for the Cure. So that is where our worlds align or overlap, the Venn diagram between you and me and you and this podcast. So for those of you that haven't had a chance to read Hungover, I cannot recommend it enough. The writing is a treat, and I feel like in these times, as we look for treats, this is one of them. Also, apparently, statistically, we're all drinking more, or rather, at least we're all buying more. Whenever I read statistics like that about everybody's buying more liquor, I think about post-Katrina, a conversation that I had with a guy at a grocery store. And this is when there were no grocery stores in New Orleans. Right. We had to drive to another, you would say county, we say parish, to get to the closest grocery store. Anyway, I was talking with this guy at Dornax, and he said that they were moving more liquor than they had before the storm to a population that at that time was certainly less than half. And I did my part to keep those statistics up. So if you are drinking and you are experiencing some hangovers as a result, this book might be of aid or solace. And in it, we get to follow Shaughnessy as he explores, so I feel like the hook, or rather the cover, insinuates that at the end there will be an assessment of the idea of a cure. But what I liked more about the book is it is a journey, well, both literally and metaphorically, through our ideas about drinking and whether that is something that is sinful or joyful, and that the results of excess, which is something that certain societies have a lot of problems with, others less so, that the results of excess, that there should be consequences.
Yeah.
Consequences should be a neutral term, but we all know that it's never a neutral term, and that we deserve the punishment, and that there shouldn't be perhaps a cure. So that's I'm giving it all away, or at least I'm giving away my what I really dug about it. So I guess I'll start with easy questions that you can answer.
Sure.
And then we'll get to the more complicated ones.
The more philosophical and metaphysical ones.
Yeah. Right? I hop to the metaphysical right away.
Okay.
I feel like you've answered this question before, so forgive me. But how did you get the idea to write this book?
That's a long time ago now. I have to remember back. It's over a decade ago that I signed the contract to write this book. If I remember correctly, I was sitting in a backyard barbecue back when we used to be allowed to do things like that, at my agent's, actually my literary agent's house. And there was a woman there talking about her new idea for a business, which was to go door to door hangover treatment. She'd just lost her job, and we all lived on the edge of a university campus, and she thought it would be an idea to go and get her own startup going. We were just, having beers and kind of yammering on. And I started to correct her on certain things that she thought should be in this kit that she would be bringing around to people, just on my own, my own experience over the years as a drinker and a researcher. Mm-hmm. And little did I know there was a sales rep from HarperCollins who was sort of eavesdropping on us. And that wasn't my publisher at the time. I was a Random House author. And so it was I found it strange when about 6 months later, I got an invitation to HarperCollins' yearly party. So I went and sort of decided I'd go and drink with the enemy, you know, and I discovered why I'd been invited to the party was that this particular eavesdropping sales rep had sort of heard me talking and got this idea and grown it into a book pitch that he wanted to see if I'd be interested in. And I thought it was a stupid idea, to tell you the truth. who's going to read a whole book about hangovers? And then I had a few more drinks with him. And by the end of the night, we were just sitting in the corner and we'd come up with what we thought was the greatest book ever. So, and 10 years later, here we are.
Did you kind of acknowledge when things are out of chronological order, but it seems that more or less the book is a chronological journey across the globe, really, exploring both alleged cures, mm-hmm. and also kind of settings of drinking, and some of which are rather famous, like Oktoberfest, for example, sure. or Vegas, and some mm-hmm. less so. But in the scheme of this journey, kind of makes sense in exploring American drinking versus European drinking, English drinking in particular, thinking of the World's End Challenge, mm-hmm. And then ending in New Orleans, as everyone should. So how did you, was that the night when you kind of chose the big stops, or did that No. kind of unfold?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I teach writing and creative nonfiction, and if a student had come to me with sort of as loose a proposal and concept as this, I would have said, go back, create an outline. I never do what I tell other people to do, and mm-hmm. I'm terrible at creating book outlines and proposals and plans, which is probably why everything I write takes five times as long as it should to mm-hmm. produce. You know, over the 10 years, really, it took me to write this. I went to twice as many towns and cities and countries as even appear in the book. I wrote probably five times as many chapters as there are in the book. The structure, mm-hmm. although I hope it holds together and it creates an arc and it moves along, is actually a deceptively complicated one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moving parts, and that's just sort of the way I work, which is sort of organically and crazily. But as you pointed out, I do try to create a few different chronological arcs, whether they're my own journey through time and space and history, et cetera, and all sort of intertwining at certain times. And I try to intersperse the more research-based with the more experiential moments, with the more humorous and desperate, just try to keep a flow for the reader going. And that is why I put that sort of caveat at the beginning of the book, saying some of these things were out of order, because I do, you know, starting off as a reporter and a journalist by trade, it is also important for me that this all hold together as a piece of journalism.
Well, I appreciated the fact that there were multiple storylines happening. One is like starting with the Egyptians, Sumerians, kind of working your way into the 20th century, mm-hmm. and how people were drinking and how they dealt with hangovers, and then interspersing that with your explorations, which is when you are able to kind of bring in the research, such as it is. Yes. So speaking of research, you mentioned this, but I'm wondering if given even more thought now, why do you think there is so little research, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. done about hangovers when it is seems like there's an awful lot of money to be made in sorting yeah. out ways to mitigate what many people experience.
Yeah, it is a bizarre conundrum, dichotomy, etc. That I write a lot about this dichotomy in the book as well, you know, which mm-hmm. is that it seems, yes, like an obvious thing to pursue, both from an economic and a health standpoint, and yet there's little to no actual research been done over the years. And it is a complicated conundrum. A lot of it does come from, I believe, what you touched on at the very beginning, which is this sort of idea that, well, you deserve this, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet we don't really put that fine a point on other health matters in that way. You know, when people get certain diseases and so on that might have been preventable if they've lived different ways, etc. We don't spend that much time blaming them and sending them away from our doors and not putting money towards towards research towards certain things that are perhaps preventable. Whereas this one, it seems there's an almost unwritten and unspoken agreement that we have better things to worry about. But that still, you're right, doesn't really answer the full question, because there must be money to be made here. There must be purposes here. And it is just, it's a bizarre thing. And I think that there may be, and this is where I get a little bit esoteric maybe, but there may be some sort of almost built-in survival mechanism, perhaps, in humans, where we, for some reason, have this belief that a hangover can't be cured. Mm. That there is no, like the common cold or like the human condition, that there really is no answer to it. Which, again, makes very little sense. You know, if you consider the fact that we can put, you know, little nanorobots in our blood, or we can, travel to other planets, etc. Mm-hmm. And yet we can't cure a hangover. It seems that we all both say, oh, I have my own way to deal with a hangover, so don't worry about me. And mm-hmm. also there's no such thing as a cure for a hangover. And well, these other things are really logical.
I think to compare it to the common cold, for example, mm-hmm. Of which there is no cure. There's only treatment, right, to help with the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And thus far, of the products that you explored, with rare exception, there aren't very many things out there that will truly cure it or prevent it, right? Mm-hmm. Beyond the motif of water, aspirin, and breakfast. Yeah. But something that I was just now thinking about that came up. For those of you that perhaps are listening for the first time or haven't listened to a lot of episodes, Drink and Learn has a book club, and Shaughnessy's book, Hungover, was the first book in our book club. And we had a book club meeting where everyone was drinking on principle, right? Something that one woman noted, this is more in response to your, when you kind of talk about women and men and their responses to hangovers or how mm-hmm. they talk about them or whatever. And she observed in her office that she is much more likely to just sort of head down and not talk about being hungover, in contrast to the guys who are like, oh, I got so wasted last night, you know, now I'm really hungover. But that has now made me think about one of the reasons that prohibition happened in the United States was mm-hmm. it was supported by all these titans of industry. Most of whom were not teetotalers. John D. Rockefeller bought several thousand cases of champagne prior to Prohibition to wait out this time. Henry Ford was really the only teetotaler. And given what else we know about that jackass, this shouldn't be a surprise at all. But anyway, so they were all concerned about productivity. Mm-hmm. And I really can, and the kind, and you mentioned this a little bit, that the worker who is, you know, screwing widgets in a factory, that his productivity will be less affected than the white collar intellectual worker today, or surgeon, or, you know, or whatever.
You're not surgeon.
Yeah, hopefully not surgeon. Well, I mean, but I think I'm very surprised that the corporate world has not like seized upon this for these dual reasons. One is that there is money to be made. Yeah. And the second is this driving idea of being productive. Yeah. And a hangover is not productive.
I completely agree. You know, this is further to the conundrum. And it goes beyond just a lack of investment in research and so on. I mean, when I get to the end of the book and really do come as closer to essentially discovering what I would call a cure, or at least something that, if taken properly, prevents hangover, people still are reticent to believe it, even after I, you know, show that I've put in a decade of research and gone through all the steps and created these. And there is something fundamentally strange about how reticent we are to either encourage or accept this pretty straightforward concept, which should be straightforward. And my only answer to all that does touch on the metaphysical, you know, which is that if we were all able to drink and drink to absolute excess across all day, every day, without repercussions, then perhaps the human race would not last very long at all. You know, perhaps we'd have a world where the banking system was failing and people couldn't keep jobs, and a simple cold could, halt the spin of the earth. I don't know. So, right?
Yeah.
I guess my point is it's moot because we're there anyway. So we may as
right,
well.
Right. I think though that there is. I wonder about this idea, because would everyone really drink and drink and drink like all day, or if is it you start your happy hour and then whatever, you're obliterated. As many people in the United Kingdom get, according to friends who have worked there, and in New Orleans too, or wherever, happy hour is your dinner, and then, but you take this magic pill, and then the next day you're fine to go to work, and really. Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Right. I mean, absolutely. I agree. It's completely hypothetical and sort of unrealistic. I'm just grasping at possible reasons for this really strange dichotomy. You know, and these are the best I can come up with.
Yeah.
And the other flip side of that I get into a bit has to do with the Henry Fords of the world, which is if we all let ourselves fall into drunkenness without responsibility, does that put more power in the hands of the teetotalers of the world? You know, their tiny little hands. And that is always a worry too.
Yes, that is true. So I want to just ask you a couple of questions kind of specific to different moments that happen. it seemed cliche at first to start with Vegas. Sure. But the more that after finishing the book, mm-hmm. I felt like your book began with a drunken bender and ended with a hangover mm-hmm. in a way, and kind of like the dawn of your hangover in New Orleans mm-hmm. felt both poignant and appropriate for this like path that you went on in this quest. And so I was wondering, when you undertook your cures in Vegas, and if you can explain a little bit about like, sure. what was offered there, these two places that you could go, the Remedy mm-hmm. Room and the
Hangover Heaven.
Heaven, thank you.
I actually am wearing a shirt. Yeah,
I saw that. I noticed. Thank you.
It's a complete coincidence. It was laundry day.
Oh,
and
okay.
And dug this out of a bottom drawer, and I realized this as we tuned in. Anyway, that's kind of
cool. Oh, I thought. Well, I was thinking you did. I was thinking you did it on purpose.
I left it on purpose.
The universe had you. That there is something to be said that these two places where you can go and get your IV, et cetera, are in two of the places in the United States that are most known for their excess. And, mm-hmm. But having established that, how were your hangovers in Vegas and New Orleans different? Sure. And do you think that they are reflections of the cities themselves mm-hmm. sure. and what they elicit, or just the time you had because you were doing different stuff in each city?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It's a great part of the whole story. I think the bookending of it in Las Vegas and New Orleans, I think, is meaningful. It was somewhat incidental and accidental, which I can get to in a minute, to try to go through your little, your points there. I start the book, in what I call the ground zero of hangovers, which is Las Vegas. And that was because of one of these things that as a freelancer and as an author, you end up doing is piggybacking one story on another because book publishers don't pay for travel expenses, et cetera. So I was on a gig already for a men's magazine to go down to Las Vegas and do one of these what they call FAM packages, which is to familiarize yourself with a certain thing going on in the travel industry there. And this was an extreme Vegas adventure where a few of us reporters were supposed to do things like fly a jet plane, like actually pilot one fighter jet, to drive a Ferrari race car, to jump off the stratosphere, shoot bazookas, things like this. That action heroes are supposed to do, or something that you can only do in Las Vegas, and blah, 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 blah. And I decided to piggyback that assignment with testing out this place that I heard about called Hangover Heaven. The self-proclaimed hangover doctor has a company down there called Hangover Heaven, where he purports to have treated more people of a hangover than anybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. So my idea was that I would drink all night, get up, go see him in the morning, have him cure me well enough to put me back into the field to do things you would never want to do with a hangover, like drive a race car and pilot a jet plane, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was the concept, and that's sort of what happens down there. But there's a lot of debacle, as you would expect, et cetera. And also, I was still learning my quote-unquote scientific method. So my understanding of hangover versus drunkenness, et cetera, which turns out the medical community didn't even have a real hold on either, was made for some messes of research, et cetera, et cetera. Right. But yes, definitely there is an optimism and a sort of gonzo aspect to that first Vegas venture, because that's how I was feeling at the beginning of this. And it felt that's what you want at the beginning of a party, and what you want at the beginning of a book.
It felt very eager.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then if we fast forward 400 pages, yeah, almost a decade later, to the other side of the United States, to New Orleans, surely there is a different feeling to the drinking there and the hangovers there, as you would want at the end of a party and you would want at the end of a book. In some ways I'm leaning into that tone and that style a little bit in those moments. But of course, but it is also very reflective of how my life had gone too. To tell you the truth, New Orleans was never going to be the end of the book. I actually had a version of the book that ended in Croatia. And there was I'd have to go back and see, but there was one version of the book that was about 200 pages, maybe longer than this one.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 100, where there are all these misadventures that happen in, specifically around a trip through Croatia. And along with the publishers, we decided that it was not the book we were aiming for. It was just, to put it plainly, just far, far too dark. There was a stint in detox, in rehab, in certain kinds of lockup, and a lot of international incidents. Things got very, very messy. I think it was a fascinating version of the book, but it didn't have the sort of buy it for your aunt for Christmas capacity that the publishers wanted. It didn't have that, you know, that stocking stuffer, coffee table possibility even.
And it is a very particular kind of stocking stuffer, though. Let's just acknowledge.
Oh, yeah, that. I mean, there's still a lot of badassery in there. Oh, sure. But and I guess that's my point, is that this version is walking that line.
Yeah.
The other version was way, way over.
Yeah, imagine. Yeah.
So basically they said, look, you know, it's a good book, but it's not the one we decided on. This is a scary book rather than a fun book to some degree, like ultimately scary. And so the problem with nonfiction is you can't just go and just change the ending, you know. So I had to live a new ending instead. And that's one of the reasons the book took so long, because after about, you know, I wrote the version with Croatia and all that after, you know, I think about 2 years before this one came out. And then I was like, okay, well, if you want a different ending, I got to go live it. That's where eventually we come around to me deciding to take a trip to New Orleans. And in the end, I think it was the right way to go. But this is I'm just trying to sort of letting you into the machinations of how both life and the literature work together in creating an experiential creative nonfiction. I hope that answers your question.
It does, and more, which is always the best, you know, kind of answer to get from a question.
The other thing I'd like to say without cutting you off here is that I fell so drastically in love with New Orleans, and it was a place I'd never been. I'd been to Vegas many times before.
Okay.
And I've been all most parts of the United States before. I'd never been to New Orleans. And to go there was so moving for me. It feels so fundamentally like a place that I belong and want to be all the time. And that coalesced with the idea of it being a place where a hangover belongs. And I don't mean that in just a cheap kind of joke way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean that in like the things we were talking about at the very beginning about sort of a puritanical ethic about hangover is much more complex and beautiful down there. The other the kind of ephemeral and beautifully dark part of life seems to just permeate that place in a fun in a meaningful way. I don't know, being hungover. And people could take this the wrong way when I say it, but being hungover feels meaningful, and it feels like a part of life there, whereas it feels discordant with life's so many other places. And like the world or the infrastructure or the or the people aren't built for hangover in so many other places, and there they are, but not in a I don't mean it in a cheap joke way, you know. I mean in a way that embraces other kinds of hangover too, embraces the coming out of trauma, coming out of physical and intellectual and spiritual exhaustion, you know, that where you're really living to its fullest. And I don't know, to me, it felt like the right place once I was there to end the book there. And there is also such an amazing history, as you know, of
drinking,
of partying, of desperation, of art there that all coalesce around alcohol, as well as many other things, that it just felt like the place to be able to sum up certain kind of through lines and, mm-hmm. And narratives that I'd been working on.
I think that what I observe in interacting with a lot of visitors to New Orleans who are drinking, because I give, well, until recently I gave cocktail tours. So I'm around a lot of people who are not from New Orleans who are drinking on the street on a Sunday, or whatever. And I feel that New Orleans, Bourbon Street in particular, however vulgar or messy many people think that it is, it gives people permission to be excessive. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there are so few places and circumstances now that encourage that aren't corporate sponsored or not, you know, a sporting event.
Yep.
Or something where you're buying admission to a thing, and that this public space that is available to anyone, the street, and that you can bring the spirit of the bar with you out into this public space, and that's very heady.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, and they do not monitor themselves. And I don't know, I guess I'm kind of okay with that, with being that place.
As you should be. It's a wondrous, wondrous place. And there's, I can't wait to go back when we're allowed to all be together again. And I can't wait to take your tour.
Yes.
You know, I would love it. Maybe we can do something together. Maybe I can do a reading, or we could do some sort of event when all this is finally over. But I've been thinking about New Orleans a lot, because I can't imagine a city that is probably, suffering economically more than New Orleans in the United States right now, and deserves it less. You know, my heart goes out to you guys. I can't imagine New Orleans without people in the streets and playing music together and drinking together. To me, the silence in the streets must be even more deafening there than most places. Yeah.
It is, although I have been heartened by how much music I still hear in my neighborhood,
right.
Because the weather's been lovely, right? Yeah. So you have people who are sitting on their porch,
and yesterday
I walked by some musicians who were socially distanced, mostly on the sidewalk. We'll see how that goes in July.
Porch drinking still.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have, it's not the same. And of course, as with Vegas in a different way, it's kind of funny we're talking about these two cities. My brother lives in Vegas now, but you know, there are no two cities in North America that survive more on people traveling and people going out and people partying. They do bookend my story, but they also really are probably the two cities in North America that are changed most by the past month.
Yeah. I can't imagine the next few months. I try not to, because who knows, you know, like that's the overwhelming existential chasm that I try not to stare into too much, because then you can't just deal with like what's in front of you.
No, I hear you. Sometimes, I won't put you through there, but maybe when it's all over, I'm going to come be on your tour. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. But when you said that New Orleans is a great place to have a hangover in, and I knew you didn't mean it kind of cheekily, It did make me think about something that I wrote down, which is how do you know when a hangover is done? And it's like heartbreak and getting over a relationship. You know it's done when you're ready to start another one. And while I think that is true for a lot of people, or rather that is a perfectly great working definition or a barometer, sure. I thought it really resonated with me. but I think it ties in a little bit too. Because just so you know, Shaughnessy explores all of what I'm about to talk about. And it quotes Kingsley Amis. It's Amis, right? Yep. It's Amis. Kingsley Amis' book on hangovers, and that you have the physical effects. Mm-hmm. But married with that now in the world that we live in, you have these existential effects of guilt and regret and a sense that something has been wasted. Mm-hmm. There's the possibility that you behaved in a way that you would find shameful sober, that you perhaps ruined something emotionally or physically. Mm-hmm. There's all this other stuff that's like swirling around in there. And maybe that's why we think you can't be cured from a hangover, right? Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely. Because who can cure that malaise? But the other thing is that within this like self-flagellation is I'm never doing this again, mm-hmm. right? We all say this. Well, if it's bad, if it's really bad, it's the meat, you know, you're just like, oh, I don't feel so great. But there are definitely those times that we have said, oh, I am never doing this again. And we do.
Yeah, in that way, the simile might, in that way, it's more akin to perhaps childbirth or writing a book. You know, that's what I find. Every time I get to the end of one, I'm like, I am never goddamn doing that again.
I've said it twice, and I have a contract for another one.
Right. And from what I'm told, and from my experience with women, and I do have a son, etc. It's similar to childbirth in that way too. And I think in some ways, again, these are perhaps deeply ingrained survival mechanisms in us that then get overridden. So,
right, but unlike the baby or the book, what do you have to show for it? Although I think in some ways you try to explore that a little bit of like what would you say are the gifts of a hangover?
I mean, I think the last chapter or so, which I think maybe called In Praise of a Hangover or something like that.
Is that the Buddhist lady, Buddhist bookstore lady?
Well, yeah. She sort of forms, I guess, the narrative part that last part is based around. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. She is somebody I met at the very end of my research who admits to drinking not in search of drunkenness, but in search of the state of hangover. And really for her, and what was reflected in my thoughts at the time, had to do very much with what I don't know if you've read the book, The Paradox of Choice. I forget the author now, but the concept is fairly simple, which is that as opposed to how we've sort of tended to think about it for millennia, that that in fact humans are more prone to being depressed by abundance of choice rather than the opposite, right? The more mm-hmm. we have, the more miserable we are. With degrees, of course. I mean, if you're a prisoner in a cell with no choice whatsoever, that doesn't mean you're the happiest guy in the world, right? But the, mm-hmm. but the so my idea around hangover sort of begins to dovetail with that one, which also has to do with writing, I think, which is the pain of writing is trying to narrow down the overwhelming feeling of choice at any moment of what the next word can be, what the next line can be, what the next idea can be. And that makes writing painful. That is what actually I believe makes it painful. And it's what makes life painful is the myriad of possibilities, and you have to choose one at every moment. And that what a hangover can possibly nullify is that sensation, because when you have a hangover, if it's bad enough, you really are out of choices. You got to deal with that hangover. You have to deal with your present corporeal situation and nothing but. And so there's another, a flip side to the metaphysical coin there, which is that, that a hangover can force you into, as we all like to talk about, embracing the present moment, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say you cannot help but be mindful
exactly,
of it.
Exactly, to be in the present. Now, of course, there are degrees that after a long, you know, when the physical starts to fade enough, then the metaphysical can swoop in tenfold and say, and all the doom-filled about the future and all your regrets about the past fill up that void. But in that delicious time of absolute physical pain, you really are living in the moment and not overwhelmed with the paradox of choice. So I think the ending kind of gets into more eloquently than I have right now, hopefully, into all those aspects of it. And part of that centers around this woman, this bookseller I met, but also then goes through that concept historically and through different mediums too.
Have you used your hangover cure since you have, since you figured it out?
Oh,
at the end of the
I
book?
I used it yesterday. I use it a lot. I use it, I give it to everybody in my life, and nobody has hangovers anymore. That doesn't mean their lives are wonderful, because as we've been discussing, there are other ramifications to drinking too much other than just having a physical hangover. But it works. I mean, it straight up works if taken properly. And I go through, you know, I don't put it all on one page very simply, so that you sort of have to read the book to understand where there is, mm-hmm. where the cure is coming from and how to use it. But it does straight up work.
Well, I didn't take notes on that when I was reading. Specifically, because I was reading with speaking with you and speaking with the group, the Drink and Learn Revelers in mind, uh-huh. but I might have to revisit, with a different, series of note taking in mind.
Yeah, it's all there. I mean, there's sort of a draft of it, a version of the concoction on one page. I forget which page it is. I can look at it for you in the book now if you want. And then the following chapter, which is basically the last chapter, has mm-hmm. tweaks to the formula. Mm-hmm. So you almost need to read that page plus the tweaks in order to really to see where I've landed. And I haven't changed it very much since then, mm-hmm. since publication. I tweak it here and there and different things for different people. Different people have different physical complaints. Not everybody's hangover is the same. But in general, there's a standard thing that I would sort of almost prescribe if I was allowed to everybody. The importance, as you know from reading the book, is timing. It has to be taken before you fall asleep. Mm-hmm. Once you fall asleep, the mechanism begins, and you almost don't want to stop it at that point because you're mm-hmm. essentially messing with an immune response at that point.
Science.
I know. Yeah.
It makes me think of it. I feel this must happen in Canada too when you were in middle school and junior high. Where did you have science fairs?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Throwing eggs off the roof of the school and stuff like that.
No, but where you had to, you yourself had to research a topic, and then there's a board, and you have to like put your results on the board, and then judges would come around, and you would have to explain what you learned.
Yeah, I never enjoyed that stuff as much as I should have, maybe, and I was way behind. In regards to the science on this book, it's one of the reasons the book took me so long. I had to learn how to, I basically made up the scientific methods and started, and then realized, oh, we've been doing this for hundreds of years. You know, it's not my forte, but this for me was a reason I had to become a scientist. Yeah.
I guess I'm just thinking that your son might also have some science projects he has to do in the future. Mm-hmm. And that there's already been some research done in the family. And he's just a half a step away from a series of poster boards with experiments done on, experiments done on friends and family, obviously not.
My son's mother is actually a medical doctor. So I think he'll be looking to the other side of the family before me when it comes to that.
Oh, yeah. I think I hit the big stuff that I, the things that I found most thought provoking. In the book club, we all sort of shared what, if anything, has worked of the things that you explored, like the sweating or the sudden shock.
The adrenaline.
There's somebody who lives in Chicago, I think, who said that she wants to do the polar bear one at some point, like just to see. So that was kind of fun to talk about these physical things, not so much cures in the way that of aspirin and breakfast or raw egg or, you know, or all of the medicinal remedies. But these other actions
the more visceral,
that you can take.
Active.
But as was also observed, usually when you're feeling that bad, you could hardly get yourself off the sofa, much less jumping off a building or into a cold shower. So since the book came out, have you had any changes in your thoughts about hangovers of kind of where you settled at the end, or has anything been kind of transformed a little more? Or
that's a great question. But no, I'd be lying if I said anything specific has changed in my thinking. If anything, my thinking has just become more positive. That where I got to in the book was where I was meant to. Insofar as like I say, the cure that I sort of came up with has not, in the 2 years since publication, let me down or anybody else who I've given it to, and my overall thoughts about hangovers, in regards to the world that we've lived through and the world we live in now, it's all to me still present. You know, it's all still the story. Even in this bizarre reality we now find ourselves in, you know, in our modern plague, other than the fact that now people have time to more time to read books like this and drink at home. Other than that, I don't think much has changed in my thinking around hangovers.
Well, I have friends who work in the academic world, And so I've been hearing about the vagaries of academia and its future. So perhaps in your back pocket, you have that recipe. And while others have not been so successful in marketing their preventatives, that is perhaps something that you could consider, because there's always a market.
Yeah, I'm not much of a businessman myself, but I'm always interested in those conversations. If any of your listeners, you know, have marketing and business experience and are interested in this kind of thing, they can always get in touch with me.
All right. All right, revelers. You hear that, podcast listeners? If not you, then somebody that you know.
There you go.
Maybe Shaughnessy's.
Especially if it's something New Orleans-based that will force me to come down there and spend time down in your beautiful city when all this is over.
Well, I hope that, not I hope, I look forward to seeing you here.
Yeah, thank you.
You'll be here again sometime
soon. Yeah, I can't wait to have a drink with you in the French Quarter.
Me too. So I want to remind everybody listening that there is the Drink and Learn Podcast Book Club, and we are in May right now. We are reading Robert Simonson's Old Fashioned, and some of you have already told me that you are stirring your way through various recipes that he offers, as well as the history of the drink. So if you are interested in picking up a copy of that and edifying yourself, then you're welcome to join the book club. If you have any questions for me or Abigail, you can send them to cheers@drinkandlearn, and we will be sure to answer those. If you enjoyed the podcast, please tell a friend, tell a coworker, say it on Zoom, whatever Zoom you're stuck in. And that is how word of mouth is really the best way for people to hear about us. And until next time, cheers, y'all.